Now we'll go to the disruption thread. Okay, let's have a bit of an introduction. For a radio play, we need three things. A story involving some form of conflict. We need characters, it's through them that the story will emerge. And we need dialogue to carry the story forward. Conflict is necessary because without it, we don't actually have a story. And disruption is a form of conflict. It signifies not being satisfied with the status quo. Keeping things as they are always has its defenders, often with good reason, but it's not always the best long-term strategy. Disrupt your everyday may be familiar to you if you're involved with events here at the theatre. Disruption is a good device to create radio drama. Even the smallest incident can create big ripples. To introduce this group of plays, I remembered a broadcast from 2018. I was listening to the radio one afternoon, waiting for the remake of a play from the 1920s, remade by the BBC and advertised in Radio Times. The Archers had nearly finished. It was about 2:10, and the play would be on very soon. Here's what I heard.
I'm so glad I've seen you.
Elizabeth, are you all right?
I was on my way to yours. Couldn't bear to go home.
Why? What's happened?
Is it ready?
Oh, Shula, I think I've made everything a million times worse.
What did you do? I was listening to that. Why'd you turn it off?
I...
Stop messing about.
I didn't touch it.
What did you do? Is it...
What?
You know, is it...
Spit it out.
Broken. Is it broken?
Not... broken. See, the wee light is on.
Maybe the battery's flat.
I changed the battery last week.
We could plug it in.
Not the battery.
Is it the aerial?
Why would it be the aerial? The aerial doesn't make it cut out like that. It's DAB. DAB can work without an aerial. Don't you know anything?
Is that... Why would they build it with an aerial if it didn't do anything?
The wee light is on.
Maybe... Give it a minute. Let it sit for a minute. See whether it comes back on. Two years.
What?
It's 2 years since you last said a word to me.
Idiot.
2 years, 6 months, 3 weeks and 5 days since that day...
Don't start with that again.
Not a word.
I've said words.
Not to me.
You have an amazing imagination. You amaze me. Does this stuff magically pop into your head? You don't have to say the first idiotic thing that comes into your head.
It's a lot deeper than I remember.
What?
Your voice. I remember you having a high voice, but actually, it's quite deep, isn't it?
It's not working. I'm going to try it with a plug.
When the radio cut out, I actually checked the lights and wandered around the house to see if the power was still on. Then I heard voices coming from the radio, so I went back and started to listen. The play was called When the Pips Stop. It wasn't the one advertised, it was a new play. It was about two sisters living on a remote Scottish island after a catastrophe. Probably nuclear, we weren't told. The sisters don't get on, and they haven't spoken to each other for years, not properly. And whilst listening to the Archers, their radio goes dead, and now they have no choice but to talk. The playwright was Oliver Emmanuel, and he'd planned it all. False information in Radio Times, the radio suddenly going silent, no continuity announcer, and at the end, no credits, which must have taken some negotiation. It won the Tinniswood Award for Best Radio Script that year. We heard it again at the International Radio Drama Festival in Canterbury, but there it didn't work quite so well because we didn't get the surprise of the apparent power cut. Politics is full of disruption, which we'll see in this next piece. We move to France in the mid-19th century. Barry Keefe wrote a play in 1989 about the French Revolution, affecting the lives of everyone in the country and replacing one sort of tyranny with another. The title was Paradise. It has a chilling opening scene once you realise what's going on. A new invention is being tested. Let's listen to it.
Citizen Saint-Just is most anxious that in this demonstration for Citizen Robespierre, there is no excess of mess.
Mess?
Blood and things.
Oh, blood. Rest assured, citizen, my instructions were very clear. I know what's required. I went to the hospital mortuary myself and selected the smallest body. My assistant stuffed the throat and lungs with sea salt to absorb the blood. There shall be no mess. Perhaps some overspill of liquid when the head comes off, but it will be colourless on account of the salt. There will be no spurting of blood like there usually is.
There is a very good reason. You must understand the reason for this. Citizen Robespierre...
I was told the reason. I was told he had never seen an execution. I found that very hard to believe. After all, it was him who said the king should be...
That was essential. The very idea of capital punishment appalled him.
Is that so?
Citizen Robespierre is going to announce a new religion inspired by Jean-Jacques Rousseau's writings. Silence! Silence! Stop him laughing!
Please forgive my assistant here. His brain is not all that it should be.
You should get a new assistant.
All the healthy and able young men are at the war.
Let me introduce you. Citizen Saint-Just, this is the executioner.
So I see. It's cold here and so damp.
The walls of this cave are made of clay to absorb the smell. Not that there should be, but in case...
You're enlightened in your appreciation of the necessity of hygiene, citizen.
I have a bad chest. The stench makes it wheeze. When I was as young as you, I breathed better. What are you, 25, 26?
This is the body for the demonstration?
Yes. Rigor mortis has hardly set in.
So the demonstration shall be truthful, just like a real execution.
Except for the baying of the crowd.
You hear that, Max? Authentic to the last detail. Except that the corpse is not still alive.
That's him.
Yes, let's start. Don't take all night.
Are you all right, Maximilian?
I feel a little feverish and tired. Let us...
May I say, Citizen Robespierre, how very proud and honoured I am to have been asked to present this demonstration to you. Here, then, is the machine, more or less invented by, or certainly refined by, Dr. Guillotine, a man of humanity and vision and a scientist. We can chop 60 heads off in 45 minutes, with dignity. We always place the head between the legs of the headless corpse when they're carted off, so the head is buried in the same grave as its rightful body. Wind up the blade, Jack.
Ah, he's ready now. The corpse is in place, neck on the block. You must watch, Max. It will give you strength for the work ahead. Look, look, look. No pain, no blood, because it happens in a fraction of a second.
Ready, Jack? In the name of our glorious republic, vive la révolution, vive la France!
Soho Poly Theatre was promoting the talents of a number of cutting-edge writers 50 years ago, including Barry Keefe. After that, let's hear something lighter. I like the plays of Nick Perry, and in 2020 he wrote a series called London Particular. This was the name given to a pea super, which was a thick smog common in London in the winter. The drama itself is difficult to summarise, but the Penguin site has a good try. Penguin actually issued the audiobook. It goes like this. Whilst travelling on the London Underground, Alice meets the gaze of a man standing on the platform of one of those disused ghost stations. As her train speeds into a tunnel, he's gone, but she's sure that the man was her brother Alan, missing, presumed dead for the past 5 years. This is the beginning of Alice's search for her missing brother, a journey back through time into London's past. We first meet Alan as a schoolboy in the opening scene of episode one.
So, this particular morning I woke up as usual, just gone 7:30, rolled out of bed, usual routine, bathroom, put on my school uniform, went downstairs, had breakfast and said goodbye to Mum, out the door, heading for the bus stop, and this moped goes past and backfires, right? Scared the hell out of me, and I wake up. I'm in bed. Took me a moment to get my bearings, and then I realise I've been dreaming. You know, one of those dreams where you dream you've woken up, but you really were still asleep. Anyway, a bit weird, but you know. So, I roll out of bed, I hit the bathroom, on with the uniform, downstairs, breakfast, bye Mum, out the door, and I'm at the bus stop, along comes a bus. I get on, and just as I'm finding a seat, the bus suddenly lurches, and I wake up. I've been dreaming again. The whole thing. Waking up, getting dressed, bathroom, breakfast, bus stop. I dreamt it all. Not once, but twice. So, you know, by this time I'm beginning to wonder, am I actually awake now? Or am I still asleep? Am I still in dream world? I mean, you know, am I? Because it all seemed real enough. Anyway, this time I think, all right, I'm properly awake. I'm pinching myself to make sure, yeah? I'm slapping myself. Mum asked me what the hell I'm doing, so I tell her what's happened, and she says, listen to me, Alan. I can assure you, son, I'm not a figment of your imagination, so if this is some sort of scheme of yours to avoid going into school today, you can forget about it right now, because you're going. So I finish my breakfast, out the door. This time I get into school, yeah? And all the way in, I'm thinking, when am I going to wake up again? Right, this time, I don't. Until this teacher looms up into my face. Mr. Dufton, really nice guy, taught English, and I was his star pupil, you know? But on this occasion, he's really pissed off with me for some reason, and he roars something at me. I can't remember what. It was something like, Alan! And I wake up again. I'm still in bed. I've been dreaming. And it wasn't... You know, it wasn't... It really wasn't until the sun started to go down that evening that I began to believe that I really was really awake. Hell of a day. And the thing is, here I am, years later, a grown man. I'm still not 100% sure. I'm still wondering when I'm going to wake up again.
Then, one morning, years later, Alice has a similar experience to her brother. On waking up, she realises something is very odd. The sounds around her are not what they should be. Her room has altered. And she looks out of the window. The street looks more or less the same, but people are dressed differently. No one has a mobile phone. The men are wearing hats. It's an earlier London. She wonders, is this a dream or is it real? And is she really awake or is she still dreaming? And if she's awake and it is real, is this how her brother disappeared, slipping back into the past? This was part one of episode one. There are five more episodes. And this is an extraordinary series with a total playing time of about 4 hours. One of the best dramas I've heard for a while. We move next to something completely different, a play by Nicola McAuliffe about Sir Bernard Spilsbury, the father of modern forensics. The case which brought him to prominence was that of Dr. Crippen in 1910. During his career, Spilsbury performed thousands of autopsies of murder victims and of executed criminals. He was the first to recognise the signs of death by rapid drowning, the secrets held in blood spatters, and he devised the method for revealing arsenic poisoning. The play was narrated by his widow, played by Joanna David, and it captured the brilliant performances he made in court in front of figures very much his senior. He was a pioneer, an innovator, a disruptor of the status quo. So let us go to the courtroom of the Old Bailey. Cora Crippen has disappeared, and the dismembered torso has been discovered. It's been examined by Spilsbury and also by senior expert witnesses. A question of identity hinges on whether a skin blemish is or is not an operation scar. Here is one of the expert witnesses telling us what he found.
I went back to the Old Bailey. Mr. Dubeen, acting for Dr. Crippen, called Dr. Gilbert Turnbull Maitland. He took the stand with what I can only describe as a swagger. To him, Bernard was an upstart. As he recited his brilliant career and qualifications, Bernard's plodding progress suddenly looked shabby and inadequate.
Oxford, a member of the Royal College of Surgeons, London, a licentiate of the Royal College of Physicians, and I'm also a member of the Pathological Society of Great Britain, which is the largest pathological institute in the United Kingdom. In 1907, 1908 and 1909, the average number of post-mortem examinations made under my supervision was 1,251 each year.
Dr. Turnbull, does your microscopical examination enable you to say whether that is a scar?
It enables me to say that it cannot possibly be a scar. I have formed that opinion because of certain structures which are found in this area which have never been found in a scar before. First of all, there are two groups of hair follicles. In addition to that, one finds, as one would expect, a large piece of sebaceous gland. That mark is not, in fact, a scar. It was caused by the folding of the skin by pressure, which allowed the skin in that area to get somewhat dried.
A Dr. Wall was next in the witness box. He was not as confident as Turnbull had been, and admitted he too had given his opinion to the defence, not expecting to be called as a witness. He made a poor show, dithering and doubtful.
The other expert witnesses are equally dogmatic. It's not a scar. They are experienced, much respected figures, and therefore what they say must be true. Then the young Dr. Spilsbury takes the stand.
After the blustering inadequacy of the last two expert witnesses, Bernard's calm, unwavering integrity still the court.
Dr. Spilsbury, am I right in thinking that you were much influenced by the opinions of Mr. Pepper, your senior at St. Mary's?
I attended lectures by Mr. Pepper, and I also received clinical teaching from him. Otherwise, I was associated with him at St. Mary's only by acting as a surgical dresser, as a student. The fact that I acted with Mr. Pepper has absolutely no influence upon the opinion that I have expressed here. I have no doubt that this is a scar. I have also said that if any gland or hair follicle exists in that place, it will conclusively prove that it is not a scar.
Is there anything which might be mistaken for a gland that you saw?
There is one small mass of included epidermis in the scar. In a surgical operation where the edges of the skin are brought into contact, it is common for at least one side to turn in a little, and as the scar forms, some of the embedded surface stuff covering the skin may become enclosed in the scar and embedded in it. I found such a piece of included epidermis in this mark, which I say is a scar, and having found that, I think there is no doubt as to its being a scar.
Dr. Spilsbury, you have reached this conclusion uninfluenced by your more senior colleagues?
I have an independent position of my own, my lord, and I am responsible for my own opinion. And I have my microscopic slides here, and I have sent for my microscope in case it might be wanted.
Thank you, Dr. Spilsbury. Gentlemen of the jury, I think we will avail ourselves of Dr. Spilsbury's offer. Therefore, given the o'clock, we will adjourn for luncheon and reconvene at 2 p.m.
Bernard acknowledged this extraordinary departure with a sharp inclination of his head. He had taken the Lord Chief Justice by surprise in the most sensational trial of the decade, And yet, far from being reprimanded for his insolence, the highest judge in the land was acquiescing to his suggestion. It was astonishing. He quietly collected his microscope and followed Mr. Muir into a side room, where after lunch the Lord Chief Justice, the jury, and the legal representatives of both sides joined them.
My lord, gentlemen, if you would look down the microscope, keep both eyes open as you do so. I will adjust the focus should you find it necessary. On slide A, you will see a transverse section from the centre of the mark, called a scar. Would you like to be first, sir? Allow your eyes to accustom themselves to the microscope for a moment. You will observe on slide B, beside it, a transverse section of human tissue from the lower abdomen, which bears no scar. You will observe beneath the epidermis, or skin, glands, rounded in shape, called sebaceous, providing the oil, sebum, which lubricates the skin. You see also follicles, or roots, of hairs, rather like the bulbs at the base of a daffodil stalk. Look back at slide A, and you will observe neither is present. In further slides, you will see the thickening and signs of glands where the edges of the wound have been turned in.
His evidence was found to be conclusive. The torso was identified as Cora Crippen, and her husband was convicted and executed. Now we move to World War II, and this was a play broadcast in 1999. It's the story of a bomber crew based on Len Deighton's novel about an air raid on a German town in 1943. It was broadcast in real time, it contained 4 hours of drama, and it followed the fortunes of Sam Lambert and his men as they carried out a night attack on Krefeld. It also used interviews of people who were involved at the time, pilots, navigators, and people who experienced the bombing or who lost family members during those night attacks. Here's part of the first scene from Bomber, where they're doing some flying practice on the night before the raid.
This is the story of the final mission of RAF Lancaster bomber WF-183, call sign O Orange, which took place on Saturday, the 18th of February, 1943. It is also the story of all the many men and women, British and German, whose lives were irrevocably changed by that night bombing raid. It is just after 2:30 p.m. O Orange is in the sky above Wally Fen Aerodrome doing her night flying test.
Pilot to crew. Once around the garden, then home. Chief has told them to save 7 late lunches.
The pilot, Sam Lambert, on his second tour, has clocked up 47 operations.
Then he'll jump off bus too.
Binty Jones, ex-milkman from Pontypridd, is O for Orange's mid-upper gunner. His opposite number, the rear gunner, is an ex-miner from Nottinghamshire. The whole crew are volunteers.
Navigates to pilot.
Yes, Koshak.
Is that glycol leaking on the starboard inner, Skip?
Pilot to navigator, we're checking.
Only small, but it looks like it's getting bigger.
Thanks, Kosh.
Is it glycol or fuel batters?
The coolant temps are normal, Skip. No fuel pressure warning lights.
Visual check.
Sorry, Skip.
Look out the bloody window.
Oh, right. Orange's new flight engineer, Ted Battersby, was at school in Lancashire 6 months ago. He's 18. And tonight will be his third op with Sam Lambert.
My father lived near Leicester when he was young, and he once stood in Victoria Park, and looking up, he counted 600 planes circling above his head. And he thought what a feat of engineering it was to get so many planes airborne at the same time. They would assemble in the sky, bombers this is, in enormous numbers, and then head for Germany to destroy military targets, and sometimes non-military targets. Being under threat of invasion is a strong motivator. Two pilots were billeted with my grandmother in early 1940. They were 18 years old, and one of them wrote to her after the war. The other was killed. and they were both participants in the Battle of Britain. Here's the producer, Jonathan Ruffell, talking about the bombing of cities late in the war.
The principle of a bomber command raid at this time in the war was to first fly over, blow the roofs and the windows off the houses of the people. That exposes lots of soft furnishings, paper, all that sort of thing, into which your next wave of bombers drops a load of incendiaries to raise a fire. When you've raised a nice fire, then all the fires will join together, and this will create a firestorm which will drag in everybody. What the novel brought home to me was that they get these guys and they send them out there night after night after night. Okay, I'm going to pick the worst example, a raid to Nuremberg in the latter part of 1944, where they lost 100 bombers. That's 800 men in a single night. I was at the Reading Festival last weekend. I was looking around the crowd. I thought, the average age here is about 23, 24. They'd be too old for aircrew. And, of course, that lot of crowd of 55,000, that's roughly the number of aircrew who were slaughtered over Germany during the war.
Oh, Orange moves slowly off down the runway, gathering speed as she goes. Those have come to see them off wave, but Sam's eyes are on the runway ahead. He needs all his strength to keep her nose straight. The mid-upper gunner Binti waves and gives a thumbs up. So does Flash in the rear turret.
The takeoff was the most dangerous time. You've just got to lift off this huge weight of bombs and fuel. And if they did hit the ground, then that would be the end of everything. It'd be a monstrous explosion. Absolutely monstrous explosion. Not an atom of a chance. There'd just be a lot of pieces, that's it.
Take care, Sam. I love you.
Half an hour before midnight, the Lancasters return to the airfield. But all is not well.
Tonight's operation to destroy the industrial centre of Krefeld has gone disastrously wrong. These returning airmen are totally unaware that due to a combination of bad luck and stronger-than-forecast winds, they have bombed and started a firestorm in the market town of Altgarten instead.
Well done, Carter. Good to see you back on
schedule.
In you go, chap.
Come on
inside now, inside.
Who are you waiting for, Corporal?
Oh, Orange. Any word, sir? Sergeant Lambert's aircraft.
I know you, don't I?
I'm Sam Lambert's wife.
He's what?
We were keeping it a secret, but it's all right, sir. The groupie knows now.
Oh.
Is there any word?
No, but keep your chin up, Corporal. Not too late. Excuse me.
In Altgarten, the last 2 hours have been a nightmare. It was impossible during the 23 minutes of the second wave attack to distinguish between individual explosions. 400 bombers each dropped an average of 12,000 pounds of high explosive bombs and incendiaries on the center of the town.
Bomb to Boogery is a no mistake.
Everyone's been saying.
Debriefing hut at Whalley Fen. Flight Sergeant Carter and his crew, dirty faced and red eyed, light up and sip regulation tots of rum in mugs of hot cocoa.
There were plenty of fires to show away.
And what about the Greens?
They don't seem to be there. The bombing were very tight, you know, compact.
Well, the old man will be pleased.
The debriefing officer notes it all down.
Less like one big fire by the time we left. We saw our sugar go down. Anyone else not back?
We've lost Zed Ziegler too.
Any word of Sam Lambert?
Not so far.
Mid-upper here, sorry, mate.
Yeah, caught some flak over Holland, just before the Dutch coast.
Were any parachutes?
None that I saw.
I see. Right, well, good work, chaps.
After that very sobering clip, I need to say that O Orange did eventually return safely. Now, I think we need a change of mood, possibly some fiction. I've chosen A Frightening Tale of Disruption by Stephen Dunstone. It's called The Devil's Kiss, and it's set in the 14th century, somewhere in Yorkshire. A group of men are drinking in an inn, and one of them has a story to tell. He reaches in his bag, and he pulls out a lump of wood which he puts on the table. It's obviously old, sawn from a long beam, and it contains a wooden peg driven in hard with a hammer. The man says that behind the peg, something frightful is trapped, and his story reveals what it is and how it got there.
Friends, friends, welcome. I wish you all good health and a long life.
Same to you.
And I raise my tankard and drink to you all. My name is Theodore, and I have a story to tell you. I have a story to tell and something to show you. Here.
I've seen wood before.
Ah, indeed you have. But this ain't no ordinary wood, no. Because you see this round peg, what someone's driven hard into an hole here? Well, that peg... No, I won't tell you yet, for fear you take fright. I'll just say, if you knew what's trapped in that hole, trapped forever, there's many of you wouldn't want to be standing where I am. But later, maybe, I'll let some of you, those of you who wants to, and those who's brave enough, come up and touch this beam. And you'll go to your homes afterwards and say, I touched Theodore's beam. And I tell you this, that peg was driven into this beam by a very brave man on the very day of my birth. A man who saved my life, who snatched me from the clutches of Satan himself. A man that I came to call father. Such was his care for me. That man is seated over there. Stand up, father.
Evening to you all.
That man saved this beam from the house where I was born in the village of Walliscote. Have you heard of Walliscote?
No.
Oh, that ain't surprising, maybe, because there ain't a living soul there now, nor hardly a building standing. Even the great manor house what my father helped build stands empty and ruinous. And there's only one person alive who remembers the place. My father there. Oh, the tale you're about to hear is the story told me from the time I was old enough to understand words by that man. Father, tell these good people when I was born.
Christmas Day, in the year of our Lord, 1348.
Aye. Lots of dates sends a chill through many of your hearts. There's many of you here remember when death came swiftly stealing then, ugly and black, and snatched your loved ones, your mothers and your fathers, your children, all to the grave. And no one tells you how or why. Aye. Death came to Walliscote too, and I'm going to tell you how and why.
That man's story is a tale of an encounter with the devil and the destruction it brought. How did it start? The squire ordered the local men to carry out a near impossible job, to move an avenue of full-grown trees. They know it's not a reasonable task, but it's an order, not a request. It must be done or they won't be paid. The men are in despair. It's a cold winter. Families desperately short of food. But there's no way they can do the work in the time allotted. Then they're approached by a mysterious stranger who offers them help. They have no choice but to accept. But the price is high. Listen as he talks with a young village woman who is expecting a child.
No.
Are you afraid of me? You know how foolish they are, don't you? They'll never move the trees on their own, will they? Will they?
No.
Because the roots reach down to hell. Would you like to help them?
Me?
Yes, you could help them.
How?
Oh, Christina, I'm so misunderstood. Do I seem so very terrible to you? Do I seem so much more terrible than the misery and suffering and even starvation that will afflict the whole village if the men persist in their folly? Let me do the work for them. Then everyone will be happy. Sir Richard will be happy because he has his little circles of trees. You will all be happy because you will have time to plough and sow and eat and drink, and you will clothe your families and keep them warm in winter and laugh and be merry in the sunshine of summer. And I will be happy because I have the companionship of an unspoiled infant to bring up in my own way. What is so terrible about that? No one will have got to know the child. No one will miss it. It will be just another mouth for you to feed. Look, I won't even ask them to dig their first quota of trees. Say yes. Say yes, Christina.
Would I sign in blood?
No, no, no. I would never ask a pretty creature like you to do such a thing. No. I will plant a gentle kiss upon your cheek. And when you remember the kiss, you will remember our bargain. Say yes.
Yes.
The villagers have the priest standing by to baptise the baby with holy water as soon as it's born, but as you'll hear from this clip, you cannot mess with the devil.
We're coming!
See, there's your Thomas, he wouldn't let you down.
That's it, he's got lots of hair, your baby has. Don't let him come till Father Crispin's here.
It's all right, he'll be right.
Come on, come on!
That's it. Now you let him go. Come on. No, no, no. One more push.
That's it. One more
push. It's a boy. It is a boy, Alice.
Patrice, I smell the scent. I baptize you. What's he to be called?
What's he to be called, Alice? What's he to be named?
Thomas, of course. I baptize you, Thomas, and sign you with the sign of the cross that hereafter you may not be afraid to confess the faith of Christ crucified and fight against sin and the works of Satan until your life's end. And may the Spirit of the Lord be with you forever. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Oh, we've done it.
Oh, we've done it.
Hey, Christina. You've done it.
What's up?
You seen Christina this morning?
No, should I have?
I went out early to get water and I saw her trying to catch a reflection in pond. Oh, dear God. When she saw herself, she ran back in her house. You won't believe it.
Tell me.
Her face. You can't see half her face. She's got a great black spider growing out her cheek.
Perhaps now you have an idea of what's trapped behind the peg in that ancient wooden beam. Finally, let's have some escapism. The plays of James Brooke are well-liked among radio drama enthusiasts. He's well-known for psychological thrillers, but he wrote one play about the disruption which can occur when you try to break a habit. The play is set inside a man called Will. His full name is Will Power. He's asleep. It's early in the morning, and suddenly... In the night, and I need you to hold me tight whenever I want to.
Right ear to brain. Right ear to brain.
Left ear to brain. Left ear to brain.
You keep out of this. I heard it first.
I'm only doing my job. When I hear something, I report it. Left ear to brain. Left ear to brain.
Right ear to brain. Right ear to brain.
Shut up, right ear to brain.
Stuff some cotton wool in your orifices.
Alarm clock, Brain! Alarm clock! Time to get up!
Oh, dear. Right arm here, Brain. The usual.
Please.
Stretching now. Okay, fingers first on the button, get some manicure.
Oh, jolly good.
Oh, go back to
shut up, your nail.
Whoa, that's the table.
Sorry.
Oh, and that's the lamp.
Sorry. Open a touch, could you? I don't know where I am.
Opening.
Close up!
Can't an organ get a good night's
it's
sleep?
It's not
in this
for long,
body.
Just till the alarm's off.
I found it. Pressing now.
Well done, little finger.
Oh, it was nothing, really.
Returning now, Brain. Mission accomplished.
Good. Okay, organs. Panic over. Let's go back to sleep.
Oh, what a good idea.
Here, here.
Closing now. Closed.
I say, you fellows. I say, this isn't playing the game, you know.
Oh, no.
Go back to sleep, Conscience.
No, chaps. Now, come on, we have got to get up.
Go and boil your head, Conscience.
Who said that? Now, come on, own up. Who said that?
My God, we're scared stiff.
Was that you, Private Marks? Did you say that? Yes, it sounded like you. Just your sort of juvenile humor.
Go back to sleep.
It's not easy being a conscience, you know. It's not easy. I don't particularly like the job, but after all, fair's fair and all that. If something's worth doing, it's worth doing well. Now, you can't say that I don't try. I give credit where it's due.
Can't you shut up?
It's the same every morning.
Even so.
Brain, get them up, will you? They're not paying any attention to me, Brain. Brain, wake up.
No, stop bothering me.
Stop bothering me. I like that. I just like that. When you gave me this job, you told me that my purpose was to be a nuisance. Be a still, clear voice, speaking goodness and truth.
Yes, but not first thing in the morning. Go back to sleep.
I never sleep. I'm a moral principle.
Well, then shut up.
And I never shut up.
Can't you two put a sock in it?
Oh, thank you.
I shall not put a sock in it, left foot.
Right foot, you don't.
I don't care what foot you are. You've got to get up and get this body on the move. Monday morning, you know. 7:50, time to be up and about. Oh, you tell them, Brain. You're meant to be in charge around here.
Will you stop nagging me? I'm trying to remember something. Something we decided last night. Memory, what did we decide last night?
Last night, we decided...
Oh, yes. Shut up. I'm not going to think about it.
And if we fast forward 5 minutes and listen to the next clip, we'll learn what it is that Will wants to give up.
Now, listen. Are you all paying attention?
Hurry up. You're taking up valuable smoking time.
Yes. Now, I'm addressing you as the Brain, the central control unit. Now, you may think you live in a democracy, but it just isn't so. It's a dictatorship, and I'm in charge.
That's telling him.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Now, the announcement is this. We have, from this moment on, given up smoking.
Oh, God, not that old chestnut again.
You might sneer, Peavy, but our minds made up. No more smoking. No more cigarettes.
It's a clean and healthy life from now on for us chaps.
Good for Brain. No more nicotine stains on us fingers.
All right. The announcement's over. Let's get to work.
Take over, Coord, would you?
Okay.
Right now, Organ, we're going for standing up.
Hang on! Wait a minute!
Not so fast. Just a tick.
You can't leave us smokeless like this.
We can, and we will.
We can be tough as well. We're forming a union. And I'll be spokesman. All in favour?
Aye.
That's settled then. Brain, this union objects to your unilateral declaration of non-smoking.
I'm not going to stand for revolting lungs in my chest. Get to it, Will, and sort them out.
Okay, now listen, you horrible organs. Stop being a nuisance, or I'll...
Or you'll what?
What am I meant to do, Brain?
There's nothing he can do. United workers are always more powerful than management.
I'll stop you breathing.
Pull the other one. Right, brothers. We want a fag. We want a fag. We want a fag. We want a fag.
Stop them, Will.
How? They're in the grip of a terrible craving.
Emergency measures are called for.
We want a fag.
Stand us up, Coord.
All right.
We're going for stand up. On three. One, two, three. Yes, and we have stand up.
Right now. Deep, unpolluted breaths. Begin.
We want a fag. We want a fag. We want a fag.
That's the union dissolved for now. Get us out of here before they start again.
That play was broadcast in 1979, and it's Giving Up by J.C.W. Brook. Perhaps you won't be surprised that the combined efforts of conscience and brain were not enough to stop Will from returning to his cigarettes. In conclusion, you can see from the examples we've chosen that radio drama speaks to us directly, perhaps more so than any other art form. We can go anywhere in any era. And the characters don't even need to be human. There are excellent plays where the central character is just an object. For example, Louis XIV's intestine in a play by Nick Fisher. A teddy bear in Theo by Moya O'Shea. And an apple strudel in a play by Mel Kelman. I think the title of that one is Sweet Tooth. In a radio play, the listener has to supply the pictures and the writer gives us clues about the parts we can't see. That's half the fun. No other art form is better suited to entertaining us. No other art form is better suited to enlightening us. No other art form is better suited to connecting us to our fascinating, complicated, divided world. The extracts you heard from this presentation were When the Pips Stop by Oliver Emmanuel, 2018, Paradise by Barry Keefe, 1989, London Particular by Nick Perry, 2023, The Incomparable Witness by Nicola McAuliffe, 2008, Bomber by Len Dayton, 1999, The Devil's Kiss by Stephen Dunstan, 1996, and Giving Up by James Brooke, 1979.